As the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra opens its new season, the BBC Proms has just completed its 119th year. Founded by Sir Henry Wood in 1895 and rescued by the BBC in 1927, the huge success and scale of ambition of the recent BBC Proms is evidence of the appetite that still exists amongst audiences of all ages for symphonic music. And yet, for decades now, we've had media reports and discussions about the impending extinction of the orchestra. From America, it's reports of bankruptcies, threatened strikes, lockouts and personnel cuts. In Europe, it's the impact of challenges to public service broadcasting that makes the headlines. Every orchestra seems to be suffering in its own way in the current economic climate. To review the current situation, I spoke to BBC Radio 3's Petroc Trelawney and asked him first why the BBC and other broadcasting authorities in Europe have been so important in the history and the evolution of the orchestra.
Broadcasting organisations started radio orchestras simply through need back in the 1920s when organisations like the BBC, like Radio Air and like Greek, German, French radio were all starting up. They wanted to play music partly to entertain their audiences, partly to edify and educate their audiences. But of course, recorded music was still in its infancy. So the way to do it was to broadcast live orchestras, and radio stations started off often with quite small ensembles, with string quartets, with light music orchestras that then grew into the radio symphony orchestras of today. And gradually they've become more and more important because, in a sense, they're subsidised by broadcasting organisations in a way that other orchestras like the American orchestras or the London Symphony Orchestra, the Orchestre Paris, aren't. They're able to take greater risk. They can play more recherché repertoire. They can play a lot of new music. They can commission new works. They can work with young artists, bring in artists from abroad. So they've become the risk takers, certainly on the European music scene. And that's why, you know, radio orchestras have really become very, very important, because they're there, they're safeguarded by a broadcasting subsidy, and they can be adventurous in a way that more commercial orchestras can't really be today.
And we saw after the Second World War that the BBC particularly were very instrumental in preserving or making sure that that big orchestral culture in Germany wasn't destroyed with everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC's role in redefining broadcasting after the Second World War in Germany is very interesting. There was a determination that there wouldn't be a national broadcaster in Germany that could be taken over and abused in the way that the Nazis had taken over broadcasting in Germany before the war. So broadcasting in Germany was constructed on a state basis with powerful broadcasting stations in Cologne and in Frankfurt and in Stuttgart. And each one of those got their own symphony orchestra that became absolutely key to the identity of the radio station in its region, and remains so to this day. You know, the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra, the SWR Symphony Orchestra are amongst Europe's finest orchestras, but they're attached to radio stations and funded by broadcasting organisations.
Which is a very different situation to what we find in America then, where I suppose it's very influenced by the development of cities and immigrants into those cities. The big orchestras of the 1960s associated closely with big cities.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there have never really been broadcasting orchestras in America. The closest the States came was the NBC Symphony Orchestra, which was conducted by Stokowski and various other great luminaries, but it actually had a very short life. And as soon as NBC Radio moved away from broadcasting classical music and started playing recordings and moving more towards popular music, the NBC Symphony Orchestra went away. So orchestras in the States started up differently. They tended to be started up by local businessmen who wanted to make their city grand. Take Detroit, for example, you know, a city that built off the back of the motor industry, where Henry Ford invented the motor car. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra, founded by a group of women, wives of rich businessmen in Detroit, who wanted to give their city a real boost and make it seem like a really important American city. How do you do that? You create a great beacon of European style culture by forming a symphony orchestra. And a symphony orchestra became key to defining the greatness of American cities, be it Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Detroit, Minneapolis, etc. Their symphony orchestra became part of the city's identity, and proof that the city was not just a place where money was made, but also, with an art institute perhaps, with a museum, with an opera house, with a symphony orchestra, where culture lay as well.
But then, of course, as those cities ran into financial difficulty, so the orchestras also did.
Yeah, and that's particularly been the case in Detroit, who are now playing again, but after a very bitter 6-month strike 2 years back now. which came about simply because the orchestra couldn't afford to pay its bills on the level it had been paying them before. You know, Detroit's a city that has lost two-thirds of its population. The motor industry, which used to employ millions of people, now just employs a few hundred thousand people. The city, as we know, has now gone bankrupt. It can't afford to pay the police. It can't afford fire brigades, and its education system's in chaos, which means that there weren't the rich people there to make private donations to support the Detroit Symphony Orchestra to the level at which it had previously existed. American orchestras rely largely on individual benefactors, rich philanthropists who give them large amounts of money, who have chairs in the orchestra named after them, concert halls named after them, who help them build up endowments to protect them when times are tough. Detroit simply didn't have that cash coming in. Its players still expected to be paid the high salaries they'd been being paid for decades, which were on a par with what orchestras get paid in New York and Boston and Chicago. Orchestra couldn't afford to pay. Big long strike. It has now been resolved, but there's no doubt that the Detroit Symphony Orchestra of today is a very different institution to what it was. We're currently seeing industrial action on an even greater scale happening with the Minnesota Symphony Orchestra in Minneapolis. Another great ensemble, Osmo Vanska, a terrific Finnish conductor, their music director. I remember going there about 5 years ago to report on the direction of the orchestra, and it was only going upwards. Vanska and the orchestra had great dreams of becoming the greatest orchestra in America. Carnegie Hall dates, world tours, exciting recordings, particularly of Sibelius, which Vanska has a particular affinity with. Then there was a strike over pay. The management wanted to reduce the orchestra's salaries. The players have been locked out for a year. It now looks very much as if the orchestra aren't going to start the new season, and as if Vanska will leave as music director, which is pretty depressing.
And Senator George Mitchell brought in as a mediator.
Yeah, and there's lots of talking between the board, between benefactors, between the orchestral players, but no one seems to be able to come up with a solution which will solve the problem. The irony is that while the orchestra have been out on strike, millions and millions has been spent on refurbishing Orchestra Hall. Their concert hall has a brilliant acoustic, but the building around it a bit tatty, the foyer and the public spaces. So they raised tens of millions of pounds in order to restore the concert hall, which they've now done. They couldn't divert any of that money because of the way the bequests have been made into actually paying the musicians. So ironically, great new concert hall, no orchestra at present to play in it. Pretty tragic.
What we do see from what's happening in Minnesota is that as musicians leave that city and go to take up posts in either other orchestras or go to work and live other places, there's a big repercussion for the whole of that city.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's about sort of, you know, music stretching much wider than just the formal concerts of Beethoven and Brahms that happen on a Friday night, isn't it? It's about the professors in the local music schools who also play in the orchestra. It's about the students of students. It's about having a sort of musical culture that somehow pervades the city. I mean, it's interesting, in Detroit, they're beginning to get that back. They've done very good things in terms of increasing civic pride in the orchestra. They have a beautiful, beautiful Beaux-Arts concert hall right in the middle of the city, but it's in a dead area. You know, it sits in an area where the blocks around it have been abandoned and have been razed of buildings. So it's like a wonderful concert hall sitting almost in the middle of a sort of former war zone. So what the orchestra is doing is saying, well, we'll go out to the suburbs and we'll find the audiences that have fled from the city centre to the suburbs. We'll go and play for them in church halls and school halls. But we'll also look at the people who do still live in Detroit, predominantly a black population, African-American population in the centre of Detroit, who traditionally have never gone to the orchestra because they've never invited them in, and said, look, we're going to make a big effort to get you to come. We're going to lower ticket prices. We're going to say, come and experience the DSO, and maybe you'll find something that appeals to you. And that does slowly, it's not something you're going to achieve overnight, it does slowly seem to be working.
But doesn't it seem that exactly at the time when you read reports of that classical music is dead and gone and its audiences are too old, and all this, and still you see orchestras coming up in all parts of the world. Kinshasa, exciting stuff there. Mm. China.
Well, China, I think particularly. I mean, the Kinshasa Orchestra is an amazing story, isn't it? You know, it's set up by a guy who decided that there should be an orchestra. You know, they didn't even have any instruments. They had to make the instruments themselves to begin with, and now it's taken off, and there are smaller orchestras growing up around it. The Venezuelan Simon Bolivar Project, a world-class orchestra that tours, but hundreds of other orchestras of young people across Venezuela. young people who had no contact with classical music at all before the foundation of that project. China, I think, is very interesting. You know, we're seeing lots of the big classical music agencies opening up branches in Beijing and Shanghai because they've realised that's where the future of classical music probably lies. You know, China has well over 100 cities with a population of more than a million. I suspect you and I would get stuck after about half a dozen Chinese cities. There's a middle class which has come from nowhere. You know, suddenly there's a middle class of 400 million people in China. There are estimated to be 50 million Chinese children learning the piano. The interest in classical music is phenomenal. New concert halls are being built. New orchestras are starting up. You know, almost every couple of months, it seems, a new orchestra starts in China. So, you know, that's one hopeful sign for the future. But I don't think we should think that all has gone to hell in a handcart in the West either, because if you look at something like the Proms, absolutely packed out. I've been there, you know, dozens of times this season, and every single concert, you know, has had people queuing up outside to go. And it's not just people with silver hair who have grown up going to orchestral concerts. You know, the arena particularly filled with young people, A-level students, teenagers, university students coming because they love classical music. They've discovered the joy of classical music. We've got to have confidence in it. I don't think it's about saying, let's repackage it and let's somehow make it funky. Let's, you know, not play full work. Let's just play movements. Let's have flashy lighting in concert halls. Let's let people tweet and talk. That's completely the wrong approach. The thing to do is to have confidence in the art form, get people in, tell them how great it is. Once you get someone into a concert hall, chances are they're going to enjoy what they hear and they'll come back.
And at the Proms this year, you've featured many different orchestras from various parts of the world. And in a way, a lot of those represent different national identities. Do you think that some of the orchestras who came to the Proms this year have their very own individual sound, or where does that come from?
I think that's becoming less of a thing than it was in the past. I think that there was a time, probably as recently as 30 years ago, when there was a very distinctive German sound, a very distinctive Viennese sound. You got big, bright brass and fantastic percussion playing from the American orchestras. The Russian orchestras gave you something rather heavy and slightly murky, but very exciting, particularly when playing the Russian repertoire. I think that's beginning to change, partly because of globalisation, the fact that orchestras are travelling a lot more, but also because of the increased movement of players. You know, you've got a lot of foreign players in British orchestras, for example, in American orchestras. Players are moving around more. I think it still applies with a few orchestras. The Vienna Philharmonic still have a very distinctive sound, and I think the Chicago Symphony Orchestra still have a very clear, rich American sound. I think that's becoming increasingly less the case, but nonetheless, it's always exciting to go and hear. You know, we've had the Orchestre Paris this year. We've had a brand new orchestra from Milan, the Verdi Symphony Orchestra. We haven't had any American orchestras at the Proms this year, which may say something about the economic situation in America.
Except, well, the Young National Youth Orchestra.
You're right. And how interesting that was. A brand new orchestra.
I thought that was especially interesting in terms of politics. Valery Gergiev, the Russian conductor, conducting them, bringing them to St. Petersburg, Moscow and Washington.
At times when relations between America and Russia are at the worst they've been possibly since the end of the Cold War. Absolutely. And the idea of a national American institution. You know, America's not quite so hot on sort of national institutions in the way that perhaps that we are in our smaller countries in Europe. And it's interesting that there's never been an American National Youth Orchestra until now. They've got together this year, of course. They've got quarter of a billion people, 250 million people to choose from. So the talent pool is pretty big. And goodness gracious, they were exciting, weren't they, at the time?
Oh, marvellous. And an initiative that came out of Carnegie Hall as well. Obviously, their outreach philosophies.
Yeah, and Carnegie is an example of an institution which has done very, very well in saying, OK, the traditional audience demographic is changing. You know, the audience of rich Manhattanites who used to regularly come to concerts, that's going, and we've got to work out how we're going to get that new younger audience. Older audiences always bought subscriptions to concert seasons, so it was very easy for orchestras because they could go out there and say, right, buy a subscription for the season, it'll cost you $400 or whatever, and you will be there in the same seats every Friday night at the concert during the season. Young people today don't work like that. They don't want to book up tickets in advance. They certainly don't want to commit themselves for every Friday for 26 weeks. They'll rock up and buy tickets at the last minute. Now, there's nothing that concert halls and orchestras can do about that, apart from work out how to work with this potential new audience and find out how to make it easy to get them into the concert hall. Carnegie Hall, the Barbican in London is another good example of that. The Philharmonie in Berlin have had some very interesting ideas there about making concerts as accessible as possible and just accepting that the old ways of selling concert tickets are fast disappearing.
And of course, speaking of politics and music, I have to introduce the issue of feminism, Petrock. And startling to see, well, maybe not so startling, but it is certainly very significant to see that the last night of the Proms this year was conducted by a woman.
Yes, Maren Allsop, a fantastic conductor, former music director of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, chief conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra in the UK, now running the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra in Brazil. I'm not quite sure why so much has been made of this, really. You know, the fact is that she's there because she is a terrifically talented conductor. She's not there at all because of her gender. She's there because she's just very, very fine at doing her job. But it is interesting, isn't it, when you think of the number of female instrumentalists there are in terms of pianists, violinists, cellists. You know, you'd never think that there was an imbalance of instrumentalists. How few female conductors there are. There's Joan Glover, of course, who's been doing great things for Mozart in Britain and America for many years. There's Susanna Malki, the Finnish conductor. There's Joanne Faletta, who does such a good job as chief conductor of the Ulster Orchestra in Belfast. But female conductors are still pretty thin on the ground. Vasily Petrenko, the Russian conductor who runs the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, has just become chief conductor of the Oslo Philharmonic, conducts Britain's National Youth Orchestra, got himself in hot water a couple of weeks back when he made a series of comments. I think he was probably a little misquoted, but nonetheless it was unfortunate, talking about how orchestral musicians might be distracted by a pretty woman on the podium. And he said it's very difficult for women to have careers as conductors because they go off and have children and that gets in the way. I mean, pretty antediluvian comments, which got him into a lot of trouble and lots of negative press in the UK and European press about it. But I, you know, maybe those views are more deeply dug in than we would like to think, that it does still seem to be one of the last bastions of masculinity. I think it's partly because of the sort of macho nature of conductors in the past, particularly in the 20th century, when you think of people like Herbert von Karajan, for example, made into a huge star by the recording industry, very, very well remunerated through all those record deals, you know, multi-millionaire conductor. Realistically, although conductors are still very well paid, the days of super rich conductors, I think, are probably leaving us, as the whole shakedown of finances in the classical music industry, you know, which hits all corners. Maybe that will begin to open things up a bit more for female conductors, but it is surprising how few there are at the moment.
And Petrock, finally, how does the success of the Proms show us, do you think, how the orchestra might evolve, or indeed the audiences for orchestral music might evolve in the future?
Well, I think one of the things that is immensely rewarding about the Proms is the way it takes risks, and those risks generally pay off. You very rarely in the Proms get a sort of straightforward conventional programme of romantic overture, piano concerto, symphony. The programmes tend to be much more adventurous than that, and I think people respond to that rather well. The fact that, you know, some of the concerts happen at 7:30 and have an interval, but a lot of the concerts happen at 10 o'clock at night and are just an hour and a quarter long. That's a different way of going to concerts. You know, there are Saturday, Sunday afternoon concerts. Maybe it's about thinking this model of the 7:30 concert, where you put on jacket and tie and go to the National Concert Hall and listen to a concert and have a glass of wine in the interval and then perhaps go for a bite to eat afterwards before getting the dart home afterwards. Maybe that all needs to change, and we need to think, well, actually, a 6 o'clock concert works very well for some people. Perhaps a 10:30 concert in the morning works very well for an older audience. As American orchestras have done very well by doing concerts on Friday mornings, because they've realised that their older patrons are a bit frightened now of coming into the city centres on a Friday night. You know, maybe then you do a 10:30 at night concert for a younger audience who want to go out, have a few drinks, go to a concert and then go off clubbing afterwards. I think it raises the point that we've got to chuck everything up in the air and rethink the conventions of concert form. What we mustn't worry about is the music. That will continue to fight for itself as long as the performances are good, are committed, are dynamic and exciting. The music will look after itself.